Welcome to the Enabled Disabled Podcast. I'm your host, Gustavo Serafini. I was born with a rare physical disability called PFFD. My journey has been about self-acceptance, persistence, and adaptation. On the show, we'll explore how people experience disability, how the stories we tell ourselves can both enable and disable, how vulnerability is the foundation for strength, and why people with disabilities can contribute more than we imagine. I hope that leaders, companies, clinicians, families, and friends will better understand our capacity to contribute to the world and help enable us to improve it. Brianna Cardenas is a physician's assistant, certified athletic trainer, and a professor at the University of Luverne's Physician Assistant Program. She specializes in pain management and holistic healing methods. Brianna has also been featured on the Unfixed series, a documentary series that asks deep questions about what it's like to live with a disability and explores why we matter and how we live our lives. I loved speaking and learning from Brianna. She's funny, profound, and deeply empathetic. She embraces her vulnerability that shows how strong she is and how committed she is to helping people. Her mission is to improve the patient experience in the healthcare system, and you can feel how much she gives herself to her patients and students. While this episode is just the first part of what I hope are many more conversations with Brianna, I left the conversation rethinking the way I want to inspire people. At Enable Disabled, we have a really exciting announcement that we want to share. We've activated a recording feature on our website where you can ask past guests questions as well as future guests. If we get enough questions for our past guests, we'll invite them back to answer your questions. Also, stay tuned to the newsletter where we'll be previewing future guests and giving you the opportunity to ask them questions before we record the episode. Just go to www.enabledisabled.com and press the start recording button to leave us your questions. All right, Brianna, it is such a pleasure to see you again. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So let's dive right in. Let's help the audience get better idea of who you are. You are a physician's assistant. You are also one of the people on the fantastic Unfixed Media series. Can you tell us why you decided to become a PA?
Sure. So I'm a physician assistant, and I actually am part of the trend of PAs who did not learn about this profession until I was in college. So for those people that may not know what a physician assistant is or hear the word PA and they think like production assistant or something like that as it relates to like media and so forth, a physician assistant is what's considered an advanced practice provider. So our scope of practice allows us to see patients and also interpret diagnostic imaging, order blood work, prescribe medication. And depending on the state that we live in, it kind of will influence what our scope of practice and relationship with physicians potentially is. So I absolutely love being a physician assistant. It was kind of like sold to me, if you will, by a colleague in undergrad. I was an athletic training major at the time. I got my degree in athletic training, but I was literally a junior in college when I found out that this profession existed. And my colleague essentially told me, hey, like you can do almost anything a physician can. You just need to pretty much work with a physician and have them be like a collaborative part of the care that you provide to patients. But you can do surgery if you want, and you can, you know, do injections and procedures and order tests. And I was like, that's amazing because all I want to do is help people, and I don't need like an MD or a DO after my name to do that. So the profession and the professional training for it is a master's degree. So people who have their bachelor's degree, usually in a health-related field, but can apply for this Master of Science in Physician Assistant Studies program, just depending on where you're at in the country. The programs range anywhere from like 2 to 3 years, which to me was like sold, because I knew I did not want to do like an additional 10 years of school after undergrad. I, at the time, would have bet you money that I would have gone into orthopedic surgery, because I was like the athletic training sports med type of person. And I actually ended up falling in love with chronic pain management as my main area of clinical practice. So I did clinical practice in pain management for better part of 6 years of my beginning of my career. And then I actually needed to take a break after I had back surgery from my chronic illness, which we'll, I'm sure, get into. But during that time, it really opened my eyes to just the degree of healthcare disparities that exist. And I had seen it like from the healthcare provider standpoint, and just thought, okay, well, maybe those were isolated incidents that, you know, the physician I was working with was like racist, or, you know, said kind of like a sexist comment, or, you know, insinuated that somebody was like lazy because they were in pain. Like all those things, I just figured, okay, like maybe those are outliers. Like maybe those are just, I don't know, like people's quirks. But then when I experienced that as a patient myself, trying to figure out what was causing my headaches, what was causing my dizziness, what was causing my memory loss, I experienced healthcare providers saying things like I was making it up, like I was crazy, that I had Hispanic panic. And I like just couldn't believe the degree of like sexism and racism and ableism that I was experiencing, even as a colleague to some of these people, and the difficulty that it really, that we encountered, my husband and I, as we tried to figure out what was happening. And so it took us a little over 3 years to figure out that I had spontaneous spinal fluid leaks as a result of my connective tissue disorder, which is called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And from my hospital bed, I was able to just start to unpack the trauma of like essentially experiencing gaslighting from other healthcare providers who, you know, are my peers and my colleagues, and just the level of, I guess, egocentricity that a lot of healthcare providers are walking around with. And I thought to myself, like, if I had this degree of difficulty with a disease that I knew that I knew I had Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, I knew that I had risk factors for this condition. And here I was literally like an educated person, self-diagnosed with this condition, with the support of my boss who helped verify, like, yeah, I think this is the condition that you have. And literally going to like tens of doctors who told me that like that condition wasn't real, or like that I was making it up, or that I was just being anxious, or I should just go get a massage. Like all of these things were just like mind blowing to me. And so I knew that I had to do something about that. So my career kind of pivoted at that time. I didn't think I was going to be able to work as a PA again, honestly, because I was really, really sick. I was using a walker. I was in a neck brace. I was, you know, pretty much had like a brain injury and a spinal cord injury because I had this CSF leak going on for 3 years, for the better part of that. And so I figured, okay, I'm just going to do my own thing. I'm going to, you know, just be loud about this. I'm going to start a social media page and like just get out there and help people. And then just like slowly over time, I like built a website and then started doing like patient advocacy services for people when they would reach out and say like, oh my God, I think I have this too. Like, what should I do? Where should I go? Like, who in the country, like, is even going to believe me? I'm so tired. I've already been to a bunch of people and they've already told me that I'm crazy. And like, now my family is starting to disbelieve me and all of these things. And so I really saw a need to have patient advocacy be, you know, essentially the central role of my career at that point. And it just was, I think I decided at the time that really the only way that I was going to have a meaningful level of impact to kind of change the, I don't know, I guess the attitudes of healthcare providers was if I caught them early. So I got into PA education about 3 years ago. And it's really been just an honor and a privilege to work with our future colleagues, our PA students. I have a whole class of students that they're now out there practicing PAs. And it literally is like just one of the highlights of, I think, my life, to have my former students who are now practicing TAs call me and say like, hey, Brie, I caught EDS today and I diagnosed them and I got them treatment. Or, hey, I worked this person up for a CSF week and I got them to the right person and they've only had symptoms for like several months instead of several years. And to know that like that over time is going to change the experience of patients for the better is just like, seriously, it's the most fulfilling thing ever. Sorry, that was very like long, but I'm like, that's my life story, everybody.
That's fine. No, that's that. Thank you for sharing that. And no, I can see like the, I can feel the emotion in your voice and I can see it. Like when you said that, that has to be just an unbelievably good feeling to be able to make that, that direct of an impact, right? Most of us, we think for the podcast and whatever I do, oh, if I can change one person's perception, I've done the work, but I don't get the same direct feedback, at least not yet, that you do. And that's so empowering and important. And I'm really happy that you are doing that work, because it's, I don't know, I'm astounded by a lot of what you said. It's like, let's unpack some of that. So rare conditions are rare conditions because most people don't know about them. So we can give some leeway there. But what shocks me is, at least, you know, maybe 20 years ago, my father is a doctor. I know some things about medical profession. And my understanding was, let's say at least in the 1980s, 1990s, maybe probably before that, at least I always thought of a physician as, and a specialist as, people who they're experts at coming up with a diagnosis, right? If they don't know, if something isn't making sense, their role is to dive deeper, to figure it out, to contact colleagues, to go to academic institutions, see what research is out there. And maybe they've discovered something if it's not anywhere to be found. But to kind of have that attitude of like, well, you know, you're crazy, or you just don't know what you're talking about, or you're making it up, or it's psychosomatic. Like, where do you think that comes from?
Ooh, I think there's a lot of contributors to that. So first and foremost, I will say that the culprit, and like, you can put me on record, shout this from the rooftop, is our broken freaking US healthcare system. Like, insurance as we have it currently, so for-profit health insurance, is like the antithesis of providing patient care, because literally in this country we put profit over patients and it's horrible. And unfortunately, like, the other pieces of why I think, you know, healthcare providers may treat patients like this are not exclusive to that. But I think that overwhelmingly, the fact that we have for-profit health insurance is the number one culprit. And so some reasons behind that, because I know someone's out there that, like, you know, is going to call me like a socialist, which is fine. Like, I don't take that as an insult. Like, it's just, I don't know. Don't want to get too political. I don't know, call me crazy, but I think that all people should have access to like basic dignified qualities of life. And that includes access to healthcare, access to like food, safety, shelter, all of those things. But with the US healthcare system, what has happened is that these insurance companies have so much power that they get to control the narrative on what's called reimbursement. And the reimbursement is basically like, if you or I, Gustavo, went to the doctor's office, right? And we used to maybe have a half hour in their office or an hour long visit if you were a new patient, like having consult. The insurance, you would use your insurance and say, hey, I have Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Aetna, whatever it is, right? And the doctor would say like, okay, great. Like, I'm going to get reimbursed X number of dollars, right? So like for a consult, it could be like $300, like back in the 80s and 90s. Now that reimbursement has been cut over and over and over and over again by the insurance companies, which leaves physicians and, you know, people who own medical practices. PAs can own practices as well. It's just like not as common. Typically we see, you know, physicians as the practice owners. But when you have now a scenario when you were bringing in, let's just say like random number, $500,000 a year in reimbursement with your current patient panel. And now that gets slashed in half to 250, like that needs to cover your overhead. That needs to cover your medical assistants, your PAs that you're paying, your office staff who's doing like the scheduling, the billers who are even like submitting these claims so that you can get money back from the insurances in the first place. And so what are they left to do but double the amount of patients that they're seeing to try and make up that revenue? Because we still have to pay their space rent. We still have to pay our malpractice insurance, which is like thousands of dollars a year. We still have to be able to, you know, provide for our families and be able to pay back our student loans. Like my husband and I have $4,000 a month that we pay for our student loans. So like when you slash reimbursement, unfortunately, the insurance companies kind of force physicians into this impossible position. That's from the, you know, outside factor. Other factors are things like just the fact that medicine itself is rooted in white supremacy. So we had like these pseudosciences.
Hold on a second. So when you say medicine, just so we can be clear, when you say medicine, you mean Western medicine? You mean medicine in the United States? Do you mean like what medicine, you know, where are you referring? Is it, because, you know, in, let's say, I don't think you can say that for like Japan, right? Like there's different culture, different system. So what do you mean by medicine?
I would say Western medicine. Good clarifier.
Awesome.
So Western medicine is rooted in white supremacy, as is academia and patriarchy, right? Like women were not allowed to attend college until, you know, about 100 years ago. People of color were not allowed into college either. They weren't even allowed to go to the same like elementary schools. Like there are people alive today who like went to school in segregated systems, right? And so if we continue to go back and back and back, we find that there were pseudosciences like phrenology, where they would like measure your skull size and say like, oh, okay, like clearly people of color are like the inferior people because of their skull thickness. You know what I mean? Just like these total pseudosciences that have created these myths about like Black people having higher pain tolerance, or like, you know, people just being like genetically predisposed to having, you know, higher rates of hypertension and diabetes. And these are still widely held misbeliefs that perpetuate into the medical system today. So literally until 1996, there were nursing techs that said that the more melanin in your skin, the less sensitive to pain it was. And so then you have people that are trained from the 90s and before that literally are out there thinking that like, because my skin is a little bit darker than a white person's, like I might have a medium pain tolerance, and that a Black person just has a higher pain tolerance, which then leads to like disproportionate belief of whether or not people are in pain, disproportionate treatment for, you know, what we perceive as painful for these people because we're projecting these beliefs onto people. And so then what we do see, and there's literature to support this, is that people of color, especially women of color, are more likely to have essentially experiences of gaslighting in the medical community where their pain is not taken seriously. It's worse if people aren't doing what is considered like socially productive work, like if they're not out being an executive or something to that nature, versus if they're just, I don't want to say the word just, versus if they're, you know, doing domestic labor, like if they're stay-at-home moms, or if they are, you know, doing work inside the home, or things that are considered by some of the people that have these kind of elitist mindsets to not be like as valuable of work. So it's really alarming that just this is kind of the culture of medicine, that unless we address it like head on and we all interrogate, like if you grew up in the United States, like you're going to have internalized white supremacy based on like consumption of media and all those things. I had it myself. I know that, for example, like in college, I like prided myself on sounding white because people would tell me that and I'd be like, oh my God, thank you. And then like didn't realize until later, like, oh, that's just because like my parents had to assimilate in order to like get ahead. So like I lost my culture as a result of like the society that we live in. And so if we don't actually like do the work as healthcare providers or any people out there, like not just healthcare providers, but like to really interrogate like some of the ways that we think and why we think these ways, like we're just going to continue to repeat these cycles. And that's why I'm thrilled to be in education, because I have the opportunity to tell this to students before they get out there and touch patients, before they get out there and perpetuate these cycles of discrimination, essentially. So, there's that piece, the supremacy piece. And then I guess, kind of in that same, stroke of the brush is the concept of ableism, right? Like we live in a capitalist society where a lot of us base our worth on our productivity. I know I did. And when I thought that I couldn't work as a PA, trigger warning, I was essentially suicidally depressed. Like I literally did not think that I had any value to anybody, not the people that loved me, not to myself, because I couldn't make money. And like, what a just like perversion of the human experience. And I don't think that that's an unusual thought process for a lot of people. And so I know that I was certainly in denial about having a chronic illness that could disable me. I was certainly in denial that like I could be so profoundly disabled by something that people couldn't see or something that people thought I was making up. And it was this whole like process of just kind of relearning like my humanity, essentially. And I don't think that I would have had that opportunity had I not gotten sick and had like my illness literally just like grabbed me by the collar and been like, nope, you got to slow down and like sit on the bench for a little bit. And I don't think that able-bodied people have that opportunity in many cases to reflect on like what gets them up every morning, what drives them, how would they describe themselves without including their job, in that title or in that description. And it really, it's like kind of a disservice to our population to not be like teaching those things and be teaching those schools of thought. But I think, there's a lot of people that find that like too radical of an idea that like people just have like intrinsic worth on their own because they're people. So like, well, there's so many factors that make this happen. Like there's a lot. Sorry for people listening.
No, it's fine. That's fine. I mean, you're like, they're difficult topics to talk about, and they're things that people don't, they're difficult because it makes us feel uncomfortable. And I think the more we understand our history and the more we understand where we came from, the better we can, I mean, that's one starting point. The better we can understand, or at least think about, where do we want to go? Like when I feel, and I don't think this is, I think this is a lot of media. It's, everybody blames media, social media, et cetera. But I think a lot of the messaging that we get is that we can't really make a difference and we can't really make things better. And, we're fighting against these gigantic systems and bureaucracies and power, right? And what can we really do? And so I think a lot of people bury their heads in whatever it is that they need, right? Whether I need to make a living, so I'm going to focus on work, and I have a family, and I'm going to focus on family, and I'm going to make sure that that's the most meaningful thing for me, and that's what I have the most control over. So there's a lot of factors there, and I'm glad you're bringing this to the table because it's important. When I would read a textbook in high school, yeah, okay, I wouldn't question the textbook. Once I got to college, again, I was lucky. I was privileged. I went to a good school. They taught us how to, the first thing they taught us was you don't know anything. They made us read Socrates, and the first General Assembly was great. You got in. You're all smart people. Now the next message we have for you is you don't know shit. You think you know things, but you don't. And that was a big shock. And it was really about critical thinking the rest of the way through. And everything, every idea, every position, every person was challenged. And let the better ideas win. That's how I learned. And so if I read a textbook, a medical textbook that said, from the 90s, that said, African Americans have lower pain tolerance, you know, higher pain tolerance because of the color of their skin, I would say, wait a minute, like, where's the study on that? That makes no sense. Like, where's the proof, right? It just doesn't, it doesn't correlate with my logic. So I don't know, you know, how that got passed on from generation to generation without questioning it. Systemic racism is a valid explanation for that.
Right. Because, and then it's like, you know, one of the things that I try to tell students is like, who benefits from this, right? Like whenever you read a study or a book, whether, even if it's a medical text, like who paid for this study, who stands to benefit from you believing this information? And it's, I think it becomes kind of this like cognitive roadblock for a lot of people, because I think just generally, like my husband and I were literally just talking about this at lunch, like generally as a society, we are stretched so thin, like with the daily things that we have to do and the level of like alerts and emails and things like that, that are like bombarding us on a daily basis. And just like having to put up in many cases with like jobs that people hate, right? And we were saying like, gosh, like how do people even have like meaningful relationships? Because like most of the time that people get to spend together as a couple, especially if they're like working multiple jobs or raising kids or any of those things, like is literally spent complaining about how much they hate their job or how much they hate like their coworker or their boss or whatever. And then so like there's really no time to just sit and be like, wow, like I'm really grateful for like the time that we got to spend together, or like that we got to just chill today, or like, you know, be in the garden together or whatever, right? And like I realize that that's even a privilege statement for me to say, because there was a point in time where like I couldn't have even had like a meaningful conversation with my husband because I had such severe like cognitive impairment. You know what I mean? So I know that there's people probably listening to this that are like, okay, well, like I'm not even at that level where I can just like even express gratitude or think about things without like spacing out. So like trust and believe, like I'm aware that people's experiences are different and that I'm also speaking from a place of privilege that I have access to medical care and access to mental health services that allow, and a very extremely supportive spouse, that I'm allowed to like unpack some of these distressing topics, right? And like for a lot of people, it does create this like cognitive dissonance of like, wait, like, you know, so-and-so that I love and respect is a healthcare provider, like, could they have done these things, or could they have like perpetuated some of these things? And the answer is probably yes. Like I probably did it early in my career too. Like there's not a point in time that I can like specifically point to, but I know that like there was a point early in my training, like on my clinical rotations, for example, where like, you know, there's power dynamics with the people you're training under and things like that, where like they'll say something overtly racist. And there's like really nothing that you as a student can do about it, because then you're going to potentially get like kicked out of school. And then like, it's just this whole system of power dynamics that like further perpetuates the problem. Like I remember in PA school one time, I was on my orthopedics rotation, and part of the reason why I decided like, wow, I don't want to go into orthopedics. And this is an isolated incident. So if you're an ortho out there being like, hey, I'm not that person, hashtag not all orthos, like you're correct. Not all orthos, but this ortho, we had a Muslim male patient. And he had requested that I not be in on his knee surgery because he didn't want a female in the operating room to see him like indisposed, essentially, because they do have to like catheterize the patient. They're essentially like naked under their hospital gown, basically. And so this physician who I was shadowing looked at the patient point blank and was like, no problem, sir. Like, we'll absolutely like respect that request. And so I was just like, okay, like I'm just going to go to the car and study. So they put him to sleep, and like I hadn't scrubbed up yet and gotten ready for surgery because like my understanding was that like I was going to respect this man's wishes. And my surgeon was like, where are you going? And I was like, he doesn't want me in on the surgery. And he was like, ah, fuck that guy. Doesn't matter. Like just hop in. Sorry for my language. But basically just like, oh yeah, screw it. And just like point blank, like freaking lied to the patient. He was like, just make sure you're out of the OR before he wakes up. And like, I literally just like was so shocked by it. And then at the same time, like so ashamed of myself now in retrospect, right? Like that I just was like, okay, like, I guess I'm going to do this, because like, had I been defiant to the person who was essentially being the gatekeeper to me being able to work as a PA, I could have like jeopardized my own career. And so I just did my best to like avert my eyes when they were gowning him, or like turn, because you have to keep your hands like up like this when you're in surgical scrubs, from like your neck to your chest, basically, or your neck to your belly button is like your sterile field. And so basically I just like turned so that, you know, I was trying my best to respect him, but I just think about like how blatant and like easy it was, I guess, to just disregard someone else's humanity because their beliefs were different. Like, it was just, I don't know, I feel like that was one of the pieces that really stuck out to me as to like, oh man, like, people like really don't care about what patients want. They don't care that these are like real human beings. They're going to pass their own like personal biases and judgments on them, and that's going to influence their care at the end of the day. And like, it's really, I mean, it's sad. And like, seeing those kind of things and then experiencing those things firsthand, like, it's really, it's wild the way that I will have conversations with family or clients that are people of color to prepare them for medical appointments compared to like comparing my white clients for upcoming patient encounters. It's just horrifying. And like, just to give you an example of what I mean, like, my sister-in-law is Latinx as well. And so we were going to go to a neurosurgery appointment, and I told her, hey, you need to make sure to dress business casual. I'm going to make sure that I'm business casual as well. You don't have to do full makeup, because then they won't believe that you actually have hand weakness, but you need to like, you know, be showered, have your hair done, like present as well as possible. Otherwise, they're going to, very high likelihood that there's going to be a negative judgment of you if you show up comfortable. And so like, literally, this is something that is an extra layer that people of color have to like think about in order to just be like, okay, like, how do I maximize my chances of being treated like a human being today when I go seek medical care? Which is just like, I just don't think that other people have to think about that necessarily. And it really does influence the way that, I mean, at least the way that myself, my husband, and people of color that I've worked with experience medical care.
The biases, our biases don't go away just because, you know, being a physician doesn't give us those superpowers. And the objectivity is, I mean, you are trained, right, in being more objective and being more analytical, but nevertheless, you know, we're human beings and those things don't just go away.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, we have such a desire to seek control in our life, like not even just in the medical field, but just like anybody, I think, wants to have a sense of control. And that's what scares a lot of people about like prospect of being disabled or like having more and more degrees of disability because of that loss of perceived control that we have in our lives. And I think that the idea for some people, especially when they have like larger egos or they haven't had the access or the training or the availability to seek mental health services, that they encounter this cognitive dissonance when presented with this information, right? And then they tend to get emotional. I find that the people that are more likely to poke fun at people for being like snowflakes or emotional or whatever it is are like the ones who are actually like the most triggered and living in their like midbrain, emotional brain, like more than a lot of people, which is just ironic. But, you know, I don't think that we know enough about the brain yet to be able to say that, like, you know, with all 100% certainty and objectivity, like, you know, this person is making this up because I can't physically see it with my own eyes or like on an MRI or on blood work. And then I think one thing that is hopefully going to shift this narrative is seeing now all these cases of long COVID, which are mimicking things like chronic fatigue syndrome, which is also called ME. And all of these people that have been sick for so long with ME are like, see, we told you. And like, there's literally like doctors that will take time out of their day to find the research articles that say, like, no, this is a real disease. Like, we know that it, you know, involves the brainstem. Like, we're learning that mast cells and the neuroimmunologic response are involved. There's literally physicians that will find these articles and write, like, responses into the journals that publish them and say, like, these people are just, like, placating these patients and they're just, like, you know, encouraging them to, you know, basically lie about their diseases, and this actually isn't real, and these physicians should lose their license for, like, you know, just adding fuel to the fire and, like, pretending that these people are, like, being authentic with their conditions. Like, what? Like, how do you have that much time in your day to go out there and just try to, like, impede patient care? Like,
and how is that? How is that even a scientific debate? Like, right? That's not even a. That's like you what you would expect to find on Twitter and Facebook, right? Right? That's not what you would expect in a medical journal.
Right.
Can you? I wanna focus a little bit, if you don't mind, because I think this is really important. What you said earlier about your sense of self-worth, kind of just dissolving when you couldn't work and you had to take a break and you were really sick. How can you? It'd be really helpful. And I do want to talk a little bit about ableism in this vein. Like, what were some of the things that helped you put your identity back together and reshape it and feel a sense of self-worth outside of, you know, your career?
Oof, well, I will first start by saying that it is work that I'm still doing. Like, this morning, I literally cried because I just didn't feel like getting up today. Like, I got up and I was like, babe, I don't feel good. I just want to sleep. And I, like, had to cry about it and do the self-compassion work and all that stuff. So, just, like, disclaimer, like, I'm not speaking from a place of, like, yeah, I got it all figured out, you know? So I think that transparency is a good one. It's just, like, knowing that, like, if you cried getting up today as well and you're listening to this, like, you're not alone. So I guess number one is knowing that I wasn't the only person in the world that's ever gone through this, and that, you know, at some point or another, it wasn't going to stay the same, right? It was either going to get worse or it was going to get better, but it wasn't just going to stagnate. So that was helpful to me, at least. I have the most amazing and patient and wonderful husband in the whole wide world. Like, I seriously can say with all honesty that I would not be alive today without him. He has helped me even from before I got sick, because I have ADHD and anxiety, which I dealt with prior to being disabled by my connective tissue disorder. And my husband's been with me since I was 18 and he was 19. So we've grown up together because now we're in our 30s, but he has been my rock. So I am extremely privileged in that sense that I have such a supportive spouse that I can really talk to about anything, and who has not given up on me even when I gave up on myself. Because, again, trigger warning, kind of get kind of dark. But when I was really sick with my CSF leak and I couldn't work, there were days that I just would go to bed and hope that I wouldn't wake up. Like, I would think about all the time, like, how could I, like, essentially kill myself so that it would, like, not affect my husband in the most negative manner, like, you know, and not cause, like, too much trauma. Like, it was really a dark place. So I'm also very privileged to have financial access to health insurance and housing and food stability. And those things also allowed me to, like, essentially allow my brain to heal to the capacity that it could. I was fortunate that I found an answer to what was happening, that I had a CSF leak, and that there were things that we could do to treat it, and that I was able to access treatment and didn't get locked in loopholes or have, like, catastrophic outcomes from misdiagnoses. Like, one of my dear friends with a CSF leak, who was another one of my support systems, really through some of the dark times of my leak, she was misdiagnosed as having a TR malformation and had an unnecessary surgery on her brain, because they thought it was a Chiari malformation and not a CSF leak. And that's, like, not an uncommon story. So, like, I'm very privileged and lucky that, like, I was able to get the right diagnosis. I was able to get the correct treatment. But then also one thing that I share about that really helped me, because to be honest, I didn't see a light at the end of the tunnel a lot of the days. And having low self-esteem like since childhood basically was a roadblock to me even wanting to do the hard cognitive work of like healing myself, healing my mind, healing my body. And so one of the things that changed my life is while I was in the hospital, I want to say it was the second or third time I was there at Cedars-Sinai, I had a wonderful inpatient pain management team. And because I had done pain management too, we were talking about like, okay, what are some alternative therapies? Because I am in like 7 out of 10 pain. I like can't stand upright or I start to get dizzy and black out. Like I'm living just such a terrible quality of life right now. And we talked about doing a ketamine infusion. And I'm actually doing my doctorate studies at this time and my my paper that I'm writing as my like capstone paper is going to be on ketamine. Because that infusion allowed me for the first time in like since childhood, I should say, to experience being alive without pain, which in and of itself was like, I can't even describe like the breath of fresh air that it was. It literally felt like, sorry, it felt like I was drowning and it was like the first breath of fresh air that I had had in over a decade. And I feel like it gave me like a second wind. And I knew in that moment that like, okay, if I can feel this way and feel less pain and feel more alive for even just this hour of this infusion, that it's like that this state of existence is possible and I should fight for it. And it allowed me to integrate like years of therapy overnight. And I went from kind of knowing that I should be talking nicer to myself and trying harder for myself, to, like actually believing that and having it not feel like a lie, to like waking up and doing the work meaningfully, not because I'm like supposed to do it. And it allowed me to really have some relief of my anxiety and depression and medical PTSD. In a more meaningful and like instant capacity than anything that I thought existed from like a therapeutic standpoint. So I get a ketamine infusion about every 4 to 6 months now. One of the side effects is that it raises your CSF pressure. So for me, that was like the miracle drug because I needed more spinal fluid. And it's less addictive than opioids. It's a Schedule 3 medication and opioids are Schedule 2, so it carries less inherent risk. And yeah, I do that every 4 to 6 months and it allows me to not take any antidepressants or anxiolytics. Not that like there's any stigma for people that, I mean, there is stigma, but like people shouldn't feel ashamed if they have to take medication for mental health disorder because it's, you know, a disorder just like anything else, like diabetes or cancer, you know? So, but that's the medicine that allows me to like really keep my anxiety and depression and PTSD symptoms at bay. And then on top of that, just like continuing to do a lot of the therapy. And, you know, I would be lying if I said that a big part of regaining my self-worth is being able to work, not just for like the monetary standpoint, but because I feel like I'm making a difference in the lives of my students and in the lives of the people that they're going to serve someday. So yeah, a lot of things. It's not just one thing.
I think that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. It feels like this is complicated, but there's something so precious and, we need to share this more together as people, right? Is how all of these experiences and how you're building yourself back up. You're not complete. You're not like, you're not perfect. You're not fixed, right? You are in process. You are doing something. You are doing the best that you can and you are working through it, which is, it's making you a better person. It's making you empathize with more people, taking better care of people, and giving back to the world. I mean, what else can we possibly do as human beings that's better than that?
True. And, you know, I think one thing that being so, so sick gave me was really an opportunity to not just acknowledge, but like, I guess, really appreciate the finite time that we all have here. And some shorter than others. And, you know, I feel like it almost gave me permission to like not have to be perfect, because like, you know, we have such a short time here. Like, why? Like, I was spending it, you know, just spinning my wheels or like taking jobs that I didn't need to, or like picking up like weekend side gigs during college and PA school and all of those things, because I was just like, I couldn't even be comfortable in my own mind, you know? Like, I constantly had to be doing something just to like keep my demons occupied, not even at rest, you know? But yeah, like, I remember just being like, man, like, you know, I could very likely have a shorter lifespan, but alternatively, like, you know, I could live till I'm 100, or I could get hit by a bus tomorrow and only have two more days, you know, on the planet. So like, all spending my time thinking about like the fear of death, and like all the things that I wanted to do before that time came or whatever, like where those things were standing in the way of me, like actually being present and living each day. Like, I was just so like, I was never in the present. I was like ruminating and depressed about something that I did in the past, or anxious about something that was going to happen or didn't happen, but might happen, and I should be prepared just in case it might happen, like in the future. So like, it really, you know, that's a hard headspace to be. And I see so many young people that are in that headspace, and that compare themselves to like what they see on social media and things like that. I know that I did that. I would look on LinkedIn and be like, oh my gosh, like these people that I went to PA school with are like opening their own practices or like flipping houses. And like, then I had to like remind myself, like, yeah, Brie, but they also like came from generational wealth and like are able-bodied and all those things. And like, you know, just like getting perspective, I think, is really hard. If you don't like make it a point to intentionally have that be like the media that you're consuming. So I know it really helped me when I like switched my whole Instagram feed from like following, you know, peers and stuff like that, to looking at like positive affirmations, or listening to like the Holistic Psychologist, which is like a great, you know, Instagram page, and seeing like just ways to just navigate some of the feelings that I felt, validation that they were real and authentic feelings, that I shouldn't be ashamed of them, and that like other people were going through the exact same thing. And so waking up and filling my feed with things like, you know, you are worthy, or like your worth is not based on your productivity. Like, those were reminders that I needed every day. And so kind of just switching up what was on the menu every day from like a media consumption standpoint was also very helpful.
Absolutely. And I think, isn't there a sense like, I was on the first podcast I did was a couple years ago for my producer now, Faye. And I think at some point or another, she asked me like, what was, you know, what's the motto that you live by? And, you know, I have a bunch, and the one that came to mind that I used to say a lot to people was, you know, as somebody with the physical disability and all these challenges, et cetera, if I can do it, so can you. And I was reflecting on that after we spoke for the first time. And I was like, you know what? That message can be so profoundly misinterpreted and can be seen as ableist to its core. And I really started to, I gave that a lot of thought. And we don't want to, I don't want to lose the ability to be inspired by life, by people, by nature, by whatever it is that like we all draw inspiration from and that have meaning to us. But we have to be so careful and so thoughtful about how we choose to do that, right? So when you hear that, if I can do it, so can you, like, what's your initial reaction to that?
So initially I kind of like, ugh. Like it's like a little visceral of like a gut punch, I guess, because everybody's circumstances are different, you know? And like, one of the like rhetorical tactics of a lot of like conservative political figures, is that they basically will refer to somebody who has, you know, succeeded despite the odds or whatever the case is, right? Like the person that comes to mind is like Candace Owens, who's a Black conservative commentator. And people will say like, well, you know, this one Black person said it and she's successful. So like, what's every other Black person's excuse? You know what I mean? So like this concept of exceptionalism doesn't allow us to focus on the systems that create the rule, because somebody being an exception to the rule is evidence that the rule exists. So like when it's the scenario like, oh, you know, like Brianna is able to go back and work in PA education and look, she's like making this difference and she started a business and she's on the Unfixed podcast or film series and she's on Gustavo's podcast and all these things, right? Like if she can do it, so can I. And like, I feel like that doesn't allow us to interrogate like the systems of like, okay, why was it hard in the first place? Like we talked about like the sexism, the ableism, the racism that exists. We talked about our broken healthcare system, right? Then it also doesn't allow people to focus on like the many privileges that I do have. Like I've never experienced housing insecurity or food insecurity, and people might almost use my like intersectional identities and the things that I've been through because I identify as a queer disabled woman of color. Like people might look at those things and say like, oh, well, she like checks all the diversity boxes and she still is like successful. And so it negates the fact that like, yeah, but like I also have like my food safety shelter needs completely met. Like I've never had to worry about going hungry. I have not had to worry about like a roof over my head. I've not had to do this alone. Like I've had partnership, like solid, like soul level partnership from my husband. I have amazing friends who are supportive. I have, you know, family members and extended family members who reached out. I have friends that organized like meal trains for David and I, like when I was really sick. So like I in no way, shape or form did this on my own. Like I didn't bootstrap my way out of illness, you know? So like, I think that the focus on the individual as the exception to the rule almost can potentially be weaponized against people who might be going through similar things on the surface, but have very different circumstances if you look a little deeper. And we should, I think, be instead focusing our efforts and our critiques and our energy, if you will, on trying to fix some of the systems that oppress us all in the first place and make it so hard so that we have these like hero journey stories. And it's like, it shouldn't be the hero's journey that I like got healthy. Like that shouldn't be like this miraculous story. Like that should be the norm because we live in an advanced society. Like it should, that shouldn't be like a, oh my gosh, like inspirational story, because like, it shouldn't have had to be this hard in the first place. Like everybody should be able to get access to healthcare and be healthy. Like it shouldn't be, or relatively healthy, or at least cared for with in the face of whatever illnesses they have. And it shouldn't be like, oh, well, I don't have the money to get the PPO insurance, so I couldn't see that one provider, or I couldn't afford to pay out of pocket because I'm on, you know, state funded health insurance. Like those should not even be barriers in the way of people being able to succeed or have just a quality of life. Like, sorry, I get so passionate
right.
about
no, that. You're right. And I would love to have you back on for a follow-up episode because I want to explore these ideas in some more details, because I am reworking that message and I'm rethinking it and how I want to say it and what I want to say. And, but yet it's still so important to have something that we can anchor ourselves to, or multiple things that we can anchor ourselves to help us get through whatever degree of suffering, difficulty, challenges, obstacles that all human beings face to some degree or another, right? So there are ways that we can help support each other in that journey.
Oh, absolutely. And one thing that I would recommend to everybody is if they haven't already checked out the Unfixed film series, please do that. I've had the privilege of working with Kimberly and Mia, who have done just such a phenomenal job of telling our stories, myself and many other people who are facing chronic illness or disability, on YouTube, just Unfixed. But it's amazing. And I feel like I've never met most of those people in real life. I've never even met Kimberly or Mia in real life, but I feel more connected to many of the people that I've met on social media who are going through these periods of adversity or living lives with adversity from health conditions or whatever the case is that cause adversity in their life may be. But one of the things that I think is really lacking in our society generally is just like this sense of connection and shared experience. Because we've all been fed that we're supposed to have like, you know, the house and the car and the spouse and the kids and the jewelry and the cars, whatever, I have some cars. If you watch this film series, like the depth of, just self-awareness and understanding and patience and compassion and empathy that comes through with the things that these amazing humans have to say, like it's so much deeper than some of the connections that I've had. Like I've had friends since college who I've never had as deep of a conversation with them as I've had with some of my like CSF Leak family, my Leaker fam online. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like it's really, I think that that's something that everybody should see, because I know for a long time I didn't think that there was really anything to be celebrated or cherished or savored about being sick. But like, instead of looking ahead to like, when I'm better, I'll do this, or when I'm better, this or that, like watch that film series, because it really just shows you like, it's okay to just exist and find out whatever lessons life is teaching you at these times. And just, you know, I guess it gave me permission as I watched these stories and as I connected with the chronic illness community to stop striving for perfection and just start embracing like just what's happening today and like the small wins. Like, hey, I got dressed today, gold star. Like,
and that's okay. Yeah, absolutely. The series is incredibly good. I'm a huge fan. Like I can't wait to meet more of the amazing people on that series. You, Kim, you're just incredible human beings, and it's a life-changing series for people. I think everybody should watch it. It's stunningly good. And I really look forward to having some more interesting and profound conversations with you. You're a very impressive, empathetic, intelligent, amazing woman. And thank you for being here. How can people reach out to you, connect with you, find out more about you?
Awesome. Well, first, I just want to say if I can do it, anyone can. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. So I am online at healedandempowered.com. I help people with chronic illnesses kind of navigate their experience with chronic illness and help them prepare for doctor appointments. I can do nutritional counseling. I can talk to them about alternative therapies, whether that be vitamins or cannabis, or they want to learn more about ketamine. They talked about it today. And I don't see people at this time as patients in that capacity. I serve as kind of like a patient educator, a patient navigator. But hopefully in the near future, I'll be able to kind of convert into seeing people as patients again in a telehealth capacity. That's where people can connect me, is healedandempowered.com. So.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Brianna.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. And yeah, thank you so much for coordinating this episode and having a podcast with just amazing guests and just really amplifying our voices, because I think that it's a privilege to be here amongst all the amazing people you've had on so far. So thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's an honor and a privilege for me too. And it's phenomenal learning experience. And these are deep, meaningful, amazing connections. And I'm just happy to be a part of it.
Awesome. Well, have a good day. Thanks for listening. If you listen to the podcast, I'm
sorry. All right. Take care. Have a good one.
Thanks. Have a good one, Gustavo.